big question they have in life is what happens when you die? And that's it's a huge issue, and it's not a surprise that people would be asking that question, because death is one of those things that happens to everybody. I was talking with a friend, although, some couple of months ago, and he was talking to me about the difference between 21st century people and ninth century or something like this. And he said to me, not as many people back then died. And I said, what, was it 80% or something back then? And he said, oh, no. He said, no, I mean, there weren't as many people to die. But every age, it's always been 100%. You with me? So it's not as if back then less people out of the population died. Everyone in the population, it's 100%. Every land, every culture, every time. Always the same amount. We all die, and it's not funny. But there is something that will never escape, something that will catch up with every one of us, and it is death. And that's the end. It's the end of this life. There is no way back out of it. You don't sort of do it for a couple of hours and then decide, I want to get back from this, I've had enough. It just doesn't happen like that. Once death happens, it's a reality that takes over. We don't get back up again. We're at its mercy. And who knows what comes next? That's the big thing. It's like this massive wall that we're all on this side. And we live our lives pursuing things in this life, aware that we're going to hit that wall and we don't know what's on the other side of it. Now, humanity hasn't been short of answers. Some people have drawn the conclusion that it's an eternal sleep. In the last little while, I've read numbers of reports of people who've had near-death experiences, you know, that kind of, they've been clinically dead for a couple of minutes and been revived, and then they've reflected on what was their experience during that time. And there's all kinds of different views that people have shared about what they went through, and they're actually quite conflicting and different, so that warns you about something. But some people have said, for me, it was totally like a sleep without any dreaming. Now, for me, sleep without dreaming is unconscious. I don't even know what's going on, so how you would know it was asleep, I don't know. But it's a sleep without dreaming. For others, it was kind of walking down a corridor towards a white light. For others, it was a time of just incredible peace and tranquility. For others, they talked about actually seeing darkness and bleak, and it was actually a scary time for all kinds of different things. But more broadly than that, people have had other views about what happens after death. Some have actually said that you come back again and again. You reincarnate it. You die once and then you die, come back alive again in another form, and then you die again repeatedly, endlessly, and so on, until you kind of come to the center of the wheel of life and enter back into the cosmic consciousness, where you'd get swallowed up like kind of one drop of a bucket of water that's been spilled out, finally coming back into joining together with all the other consciousness of existence and being one with it, ceasing to exist as your own independent consciousness, but now with the worldwide universal one. Others, though, have said there's nothing. When you die, that's it. You cease to exist. Like any other piece of matter, you just crumble down into the dirt, into the dust, and your matter disintegrates, and there is nothing of you left. Well, into that mix of varying opinions comes the Bible. And it has a very simple answer to the question, what happens when we die? And I want to take you and show you that in a couple of places. Come with me to Hebrews chapter 9. If you've got a Bible, flip up there. If you haven't, just listen in. I'll only be there very briefly. But Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27, a very simple verse in the Bible. And when you flip there, if you haven't got a Bible, just to reaffirm, go and grab, if you don't own one, go and grab one at the information desk. Not if you've just forgotten to bring it tonight, don't do that. But if you don't own one, go and grab one. But Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27, listen to these very simple but stark words. People are destined to die once, and after that, face judgment. People are destined to die once, and after that, after death, face judgment. This is very simple and clear. It's a conclusion or an assertion that cuts right through the options. It rules out reincarnation. Men and women are destined to die once, not repeatedly, not through the reinvigoration of karma's work on your soul or whatever. No, it's death once. It cuts through cosmic union. It's not able to fit in together with the Bible's notion that somehow all our consciousnesses all meld together in one. No. We die once and face judgment, says the Bible. And it's a judgment that comes from a personal judge, the Creator God, the one before whom we will stand. Now, Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27 is not an isolated idea. It's a very stark expression of it, but it's there in many places in the Bible, and it's particularly vivid in the talk, in the speech of Jesus. And I want to take you to that part of the Bible, which is in your EV News. You've got in your hands there the passage, the bit of paper that's with you there. Come with me to Luke chapter 16, and you'll see it expressed very vividly by Jesus himself. He gives an account of two men, a rich man, verse 19, a man who lived in luxury, dressed in purple. Purple was a very expensive cloth. It was very difficult to actually create purple dye, a very expensive dye. Lived in luxury every day. But there was another man, a beggar, named Lazarus, who was covered in sores, longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. Here's a man destitute, impoverished, in deep need, relied upon just the scraps from the rich man, who seems to give no account to him, to not even notice him. And you get that actually picked up in the way that the rich man eventually talks about Lazarus. He almost says to Abraham, "Tell him what to do for me." The rich man has this sense of privilege and power and authority, but both of them die. Now, both of them are fictitious, just to be clear there. They're not two real people, but the fictitious character doesn't change the truth that's conveyed here. And Jesus says those two fictitious people, let's say, but they both die, and what's revealed in their death is a separation. Verse 22, the time comes when the beggar dies. The angel carried him to Abraham's side. That's a reference to going to be in the presence of the blessed ones, Abraham, the great father of these people, God's blessed one. It's a reference to being blessed. The rich man also dies and is buried in Hades, where he was in torment. He looked up and saw Abraham far away. He is now in the place of the dead. He is separated from God, cut off from God. And he's in place of torment. That language of torment is used a number of times through that text. He says, in fact, verse 24, "Have pity on me, send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in the water and cool my tongue because I'm in agony in this fire." He repeats it again back down there in verse 28, "Rescue my brothers from this place of torment." Lazarus now in a place of blessing and comfort. The rich man in a place of torment and agony, separated. Now, a lot of it's clearly poetic. A lot of it is fictitious. But it's the vehicle to convey very clear truths that Jesus is convinced about, that there is a judgment to come. And that judgment impacts people's eternal destiny. There is a life beyond, and it's a life where there will be a separation of people. It's not a time in the future beyond death where everybody will automatically be ushered into a wonderful existence where they'll be glad, happy and at peace. Jesus says this separation occurs, some to blessing, some to cursing. And verse 26, there is a great chasm set between these two places so that people can't cross over. This is fixed eternally. This conviction about the judgment of God that will cause some to be comforted and blessed eternally, some to be punished eternally, this conviction of that separation is all the way through Jesus. Do you know, it was asked me, you know, is it possible that someone else has injected this story into Jesus' words? I mean, he didn't actually say it. Look, it isn't possible, but even allowing that it might be, this thinking is so embedded in so much of what Jesus says in so many places. To try and rip it out, you actually lose the person, the historical person of Jesus. It is clearly what he thought, given the number of times he talked about it. He speaks about the things of hell more than any other character in the New Testament reported for us. And he speaks about it with great care, with great seriousness. He talks about it soberly, with a clear sense that it's real and it's frightening. Come with me to another part where he speaks about these same things, Mark chapter 9. Mark chapter 9, again, just listen in, but Mark chapter 9. Have a look there in verse 42. Have a look at verse 43, actually. Let's jump down to there. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life maimed than to have two hands and go to hell. If what I do with my hand causes me to end up condemned into hell, it's better to lose the hand and go into life maimed than end up in that place. Now, it's so intense for Jesus that he repeats it a number of times with different images. Have a look there in verse 45. If your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better to enter life crippled than have two feet and be thrown into hell. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. It's better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into hell, where the worms that eat do not die and the fire is not quenched. Now, it's hard to get a more serious expression of the deep concern that Jesus has about these realities. It is a terrifying vision of the future. Judgment, which will leave real people who are flesh and bone, real people, many people, lost eternally. It's a terrifying vision, which leads to the next point that I want to wrestle with you over. Is it true? Is it true? As a community, we've pretty much settled the question, actually. We've heard this terrifying vision of Jesus, and we kind of breathe this sigh of relief, and we say, thank God it's not true. We don't know why it's not true. We're just sure it can't be true because it's a horrible vision. We're convinced that it's a hangover for some kind of primitive, narrow-minded people who were full of hate and probably also believed the earth was flat. They were just naive, fundamentalist. I mean, that's Jesus, isn't it? Full of hate. It is an odd thing to think that he would be the one that speaks of it so often when we see him as a figure of such towering care and love and compassion. That he speaks of it is something to take note of. But for us, we've decided, no, it can't be possible. And in fact, what I've noticed over the years is that people live with all kinds of possible options about what happens when you die, but this one, the Jesus one, almost never gets mentioned. I go to lots of funerals. And the funerals that, you know, I'm not part of, we're not part of, that just happen out there with others, I never hear the vision of Jesus about what happens after death spoken of. Why? Why are people so sure of all the options, this one can't be true? You know, it's interesting too, in a world that's so into relativism. You know what relativism is? It's the sense that your opinion is just relative to your circumstance and yourself, so that every view is valid, it's true for you. If you want to believe that, then it's true for you. If you want to believe something different, it's true for you, and it's all just relative to your context and situation. In a world where everyone's view is accepted as valid and it doesn't matter what you believe, there is one place where we become quite clearly objective and there can only be one truth, and that's the context of life after death. I was talking with a man once about his thoughts on Jesus, and we were sharing back and forward, and he was reflecting on, you know, a kind of a generous spirit that said, look, you know, if people want to believe Jesus is like that, then that's good for them. I'm happy for them to do that. It's if it helps, great. If people want to believe this about Jesus, I think that's great too. And if people want to just reject and deny, well, that's got to be good for them as well. And he was kind of this very generous accepting of all different views and so on. I then said to him, well, hang on, what do you think about what happens after you die? And he said, oh, we just cease to exist. We cease to exist? Yes, we. Do you mean all of us? But what if I believe differently? Well, that won't happen, will it? Do you see, suddenly now he's dealing with an awareness that we're talking about concrete reality, that you can't just bend by your opinion. Some things do bend by your opinion. I had families just come back from New Zealand, and where it rained every day. And you kind of wonder about, well, it is the land of the long white cloud, and so you kind of expect some rain, I guess, but very difficult to live in a camper van in the context of raining every day. But just imagine someone asked you, is New Zealand a good place to go and have a holiday? Well, you can have different opinions on that, or no opinion at all, and it really wouldn't matter. And in fact, your opinion might shape your experience. That is to say, if I'm really convinced it's a good place to holiday, me going there might actually make it a good holiday because I'm so convinced it will be. It'll actually shape my experience of it. There are some things that your very opinion shapes the outcomes. But there are other things where your opinion doesn't shape the outcome at all. I'll give you an example. Gravity. You climb up on the top of the building outside and scream for all the world that you think gravity is just some kind of construct created by the masses to all the great leadership to stop us from experiencing our freedoms and liberations, and it's just a nonsense and gravity doesn't exist, and jump. What's going to happen? Well, it doesn't matter how strongly you believe, how much faith you have in your opinion, it's not true for you. It won't stop you hitting the ground in a very painful way. We'll have to clean up after you. It won't be tidy. My point is, just because you believe a certain thing in some contexts, it doesn't change the outcome at all. Reality is there. It doesn't bend to fit your opinion. What happens when we die? It's like that. We rightly realize that what we believe about it won't make it true for us. You might want to believe that there's nothing after death, but just believing it won't make it true. You might want to believe that there is judgment. Just believing it won't make it true. It's critically important, therefore, to work out what is true. What does happen after we die? All opinions can't be right. If Jesus is right, that there is a judgment, that there is a separation eternally of some people from another by God's judgment acts, then whether we like it or not, or agree with it or not, that will be our future. What I'm trying to do with us tonight is compel you to see that this issue is an issue of the utmost importance. What will happen? Is the vision of Jesus true? Is there a judgment? How will that impact us? How do you work out which is true? Well, I'll give you one way you don't work it out, and then I'll give you a way you do. The way you don't work it out is by thinking inward and looking at your feelings about it. How you feel about judgment won't make it true or false. In our culture today, when things feel wrong or appear cruel to us, we just decide they can't be true. That doesn't make it so. Because in our superficial engagement with this issue, and I want to suggest that's often the case, we have cast off what we don't like, the thought that some people might be condemned. We've cast that off, sure that that couldn't possibly be true because it's so horrible and ugly. And in casting off judgment, we've actually cut out of the world and our lives things that are powerfully important that have gone with it. You know, if there is no judgment, here's what happens to our lives. If at the end of this life there is just death and there is no judgment, or there's the kind of judgment where everyone gets a prize, where everyone is rewarded with blessing and wonderful future joy, and if there is no judgment or everyone just gets rewarded, then the implications of that are this. It doesn't matter what you do in this life. Live however you like. Be like the rich man who uses and abuses and absorbs to himself all that he wants and lives in luxury, crushing people around him. Live like that if you want. And if you can get away with it, you're just going to die anyway. So what's it matter what people think of you? If you're able to get over the way people think of you and it not affect you, well, go for it. Because at the end of death, nothing's there anyway, so it doesn't matter how you've lived your life. But if you find it really helpful to be a servant of others and give yourself out for others, you find that rewarding and fulfilling, well, do that. But it doesn't really matter that you have, because you'll die and it'll all not have any impact. It'll not make any difference anyway, because the people you've loved and served, they'll die as well and they'll not. It doesn't matter what you do. If there is no judgment, our lives are emptied of meaning. There is no such thing as right and wrong. There is no such thing either as justice. Now, I want to give you a little bit of a fuller expression of this one to give a flavour to the whole. And it comes, I want to give it to you by reflecting on what a man has written, a man called Miroslav Volf, who actually has considered these issues at some length because he lived in the context of terrible warfare around the Macedonian-Croatian context there some decades ago. And listen carefully to what he has to say. This is an extended quote, but listen in. My thesis is that the practice of non-violence requires a belief in divine vengeance. So what I'm going to put to you is, being people that don't practice violence needs the conviction that the God who exists will judge. My thesis will be unpopular with a man in the West. But imagine speaking to people as I have, whose cities and villages have been first plundered, then burned and levelled to the ground, whose daughters and sisters have been raped, whose fathers and brothers have had their throats slit. Your point to them that we should not retaliate? Why not? Well, I say, the only means of prohibiting violence by us is to insist that violence is only legitimate when it comes from God. Violence thrives today, secretly nourished by the belief that God refuses to take the sword. Violence, we think violence flourishes today because people believe in a God who judges. No. What he notes is that violence flourishes when you secretly deep down believe that no one's going to set it right and you have to. At the end of this life, the people who have raped and tortured and slit people's throats and burned and pillaged, if at the end of death there's nothing happens to them and they get away with it, then justice is not served. And so we have to take it into our own hands to meet justice, to bring it to bear. And so I have to get the sword out if I want to see justice done, because it's not going to be fixed up any other way. He says it takes the quiet of a suburb for the birth of the notion that human nonviolence is the result of a God who refuses to judge. In a scorched land, soaked in the blood of the innocent, that idea will invariably die. If God were not angry at injustice and deception and did not make a final end to violence in judgment, that God would not be worthy of our worship. What he's saying is, it's only possible to imagine that violence is created by a God who is a judging God. It's only possible to imagine that we can live a life of non-violence if we just get rid of the notion of a God who judges. It's only possible to imagine all of that if you're living in Springfield or Wamberal or Terrigal or Sydney suburbs or some other peaceful place where you've not seen the slaughter that he's seen. But as soon as you go to those places and you see people around just destroyed by the oppression of others, you cry out for vengeance and justice. And if there's a God who won't do it, you have to. And so it breeds violence amongst us. You know, we don't like the idea that someone might be condemned. And so we get rid of the notion of judgment to protect us from that ugly thought. But what happens when we do that is that you cut the end off life and all meaning and value and right, wrong, justice just bleed out the end of it so that there's nothing left. Dignity, worth, value go as well ultimately. We live in a universe in the end, if there is no judgment, where what we do doesn't matter and we don't matter. Now, none of these insights mean that Jesus' vision of what happens when we die must be true. These don't prove that it must be true, but they are powerful pointers. They're powerful pointers because we are intrinsically written into our DNA, people who love justice. Is that just an evolutionary fault or some purpose that's been bred into us? Or has it been given to us by a God who loves justice? Judgment can't be ruled out simply because some people suffer judgment. If you remove suffering by removing judgment, you lose so many other pieces that are priceless and massively important in our lives. And all of this, therefore, takes us bigger. Let me go a little bit bigger with you. You know, Jesus is teaching about judgment, the fact that God will judge, is part of a larger way of understanding existence. His deepest sense of existence is this, that we're not here by accident, that you and I were created by a personal God who made us out of love to be people of love, and who cares so much that we be people of love that he holds us to account for how we have lived. And he has given us the basis of that accounting, which isn't some kind of weirdly arbitrary exam that you have to sit. It's not as if the judgment that God presents to us at the end is this kind of theological exam, and if you get one wrong, you go to hell. No. It's not some arbitrary, weird thing like that. It's a judgment about love. Let me try and give you this. Think with me for a second. I mean, not that you haven't been, but try and think with me on this one. It would make sense that, well, think, what do you think is the greatest sin in life? Don't call out or anything, but just think. What do you think is the greatest sin that a person can commit? Don't say anything. What's the greatest sin that a person can commit? Is it rape? Is it torture? It would make sense, wouldn't it, that the greatest sin that a person commits would be breaking the greatest commandment. If we could know what the greatest commandment is, we would know what the greatest sin is. What's the greatest commandment? Well, Jesus has told us. The greatest commandment, he says, is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And a second is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. Notice that. The two great commandments are full of love because God made us out of love to be people like him, to be people of love. And here's the deal. One of the instincts, one of the first instincts of a person of love, a person who has matured into someone who is a person of love, one of their first instincts is to recognize what's been given to them by others and be grateful for it. It's just a simple reality. It's the immature and the unformed and the selfish that refuse to see that I've been given so much and I should be in humility thankful for it. That's selfish and proud and immature. But the loving person appreciates all that. Now, here's the deal. God has given us all things. You've received much from other people. But God has given you life, breath, everything. He has given you the world you live in. We have messed it up and there's all kinds of terrible things that we've brought, but every aspect of beauty, every moment of pleasure, every piece of health that you enjoy is a gift from God. Just upholding you at the very moment to have life, to think and consider is a gift from God. The very demonstration that you have love in you is that you will in humility recognize that and be full of gratitude for the magnitude of what he's given you. And to fail to do that is evidence of a very deep selfish instinct where you've turned in on yourself. God made us for love, and evidence that we are loving is that we first recognize Him and give thanks. Now, if all this is true, then it just heightens the seriousness of that judgment. Because if God judges us according to love, whether we've loved Him as we ought, whether we've loved others as ourselves, if He judges us there, which of us has come close to being acceptable? I haven't. I've fallen far short. Not one of us will stand on that day. Not because we fail some arbitrary set of quizzes, but because we have turned in on ourselves. We have deliberately chosen to be people who are focused on our own interests. You know, one of the things that's the shape of our culture today is that we pursue life to be happy. We pursue life to be fulfilled. And fulfillment is about me being happy. The very essence of the aim that our world has, our culture encourages us to have, is an aim all about me. Me being happy and fulfilled. Whereas God calls us to be concerned for love, to count others better than ourselves, to look to the interests of others, to particularly recognize the gifts that we've received from others, to be thankful and full of gratitude, and yet we're pursued a course that's actually about selfishness. It is a deep, profound problem that we are in. Now, I know many of us still struggle to believe that Jesus and His vision of what happens after death is true. It puts so much pressure on us. Are you saying that we're all condemned? Is it possible that we could all spend our life eternally in hell? It just seems so horrible. Let me cut right to it and give you two things that not only heighten the seriousness of what Jesus teaches, but make it clear that it is certainly true. Two things, and then I'll throw for questions. The first one is the death of Jesus. Jesus speaks with great seriousness about this judgment to come. He warns, he cries, he weeps, he speaks with strength, he gets alongside people, he tries to explain, but ultimately he says, the reason I've come is to give my life as a ransom for many. Because the God of love, who loved us and made us for love and sees that we've turned our backs on Him, still loves. And He pursues us. And He comes in the person of His Son to rescue us. Because He knows that we can't stand on that day. Our lives won't be worthy. We don't measure up. And so He comes to send a Saviour, the Lord Jesus, to give up His life to pay the debt we owe, to actually stand in the place of the judgment that we ought to have. He takes the judgment in our place, so that we can be forgiven, not because we're worthy of it, but because God is gracious and loving and merciful. There has to be a price paid because He's just, but He sends His Son to pay that price. And He secures for us not only the truth that He does and will judge, but that He has judged in the person of His Son so that we can escape it. What an extraordinary thing He's done. But get this, when you understand that Jesus is God come amongst us to die to save us, what that tells you is we desperately need saving, because there's no other way except that such a price is paid. You know, I heard the story of Aaron Ralston. I've mentioned it to you before, I think, sometime previously, but Aaron Ralston was a kind of canyon and a rock climber and so on, and he was in the kind of wilderness areas of the United States and up in a canyon and rappelling down a canyon wall, and as he came onto a particular ledge, I think he put his hand there to keep moving forward, and a massive boulder rolled onto his hand and pinned him in place, and he was stuck there for days. Now, what do you think he's doing for those days? He's calling out. He's hoping someone comes. He's trying to pull his hand out. He's trying to move the rock. After 5.5 days, He couldn't budge his hand. This place is so isolated, there's no one coming. He realized the only chance of survival is if he gets himself out. So after 5.5 days, he breaks the bones in his... This is an MA-rated illustration, all right? He breaks the bones of his forearm and then gets a penknife out of his back pocket or somewhere, and an old one, just a, you know, cheap nut, and saws the flesh of his hand through and the sinews and tears his hand off, tears his arm off, and leaves his hand embedded under the boulder. And then marches a million miles or however far he went and swam across an ocean or something and was safe. He got out. Now, Aaron Ralston has now gone on to the motivational speaking tour throughout the state. So he goes around the place now telling people about how, you know, you can do more than you realise and you need to actually step up and take things and so on. But just imagine this, picture this for a minute. This is fictitious, but imagine. He's at a conference and he's speaking all the motor. He's talking about how his arm's still back there and he's saying, you know, you need to do it. Someone comes up to him at the end of the talk and says, great talk. I think I might have been in the canyon you were in. And he says, did that canyon look like... And Aaron goes, yeah, it looked exactly like that. And he goes, and did it have kind of a series of shelves and so on? Yeah, exactly. That's the same place. And was there a boulder that looked exactly like this? And Aaron goes, yeah. And he says, was that the boulder that fell on your hand? Yeah, that's the boulder that fell on my hand. And he says to Aaron, did you know that if you just push it like this, it rolls back? And what do you think Aaron does hearing that? He kind of goes, oh. Actually, no, he goes, because he hasn't got that one. He goes, oof. And he goes, you're joking. No, I've been there. You just push it this way and bang. And Aaron's going, well, dang. And he's going, you know, do you mean I didn't need to pay that price? I could have just, yeah. No, here's what Aaron Rolson's doing. He's going, for 5.5 days... I made sure I checked every possible way of getting my hand out from underneath that rock. And in fact, it took a dozen men to move the rock to get his hand out later, which I don't know is in his freezer or something at home. But, you know, like he's saying, I tried everything to get... And do you think I only did that? I only paid that price because there was no other way. Here's where the illustration applies. What you have presented for us in the Bible is that God sends his son, his only son, to die to rescue us. Which tells you what about our need for rescue? And it tells you what about other possible ways of being safe. Imagine fronting up before God and saying to God, you know, people talked about this judgment. I wasn't convinced, but I just tried to live a decent life because I figured that if I'd just been a decent enough person, when I stood before you, you'd realise that, yeah, you found it too hard to believe, but you were still decent and you'll be okay with me. And God will go, he'll go, you mean I killed my son? Well, it's a clumsy way of expressing. I put judgment upon my son such that he died, and all you needed to do was be decent? Why didn't I think of that? Why didn't I realise that all you needed to be was a half-decent bloke who didn't kill anyone and you would have been okay? If that's all it took, I didn't need to have my son die? No. God will respond by saying, I spent eternity trying to find another way. I didn't just pay the price of my son because that was the first thought that came into my mind. It's because hell is so serious. It's because your salvation can be found in no other way. And out of love, I wanted you to find pardon and mercy and forgiveness. And so I was prepared to pay such a price because there is no other way for you, for me, to be forgiven. Don't come to me unforgiven, imagining that you can just be decent. The death of Jesus speaks powerfully about the seriousness of what Jesus taught, about the reality of it. But I'll give you the last thing that makes it abundantly clear that it's true. And it's the resurrection of Jesus. Three days after he died, he was raised again to life, not just a near-death experience, not just 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 3 days, dead and buried. He came back to life again from the age beyond and expounded and taught and clarified, made certain that there is a life beyond, that it's found in Jesus, that he is the key, he is the Lord, he is the giver of life. He smashed down that wall that shrouds what's beyond. You only need one person to come back to know what's beyond. Jesus has done that. And he didn't do it in a corner. He did it in the near past with plenty of historical evidence around it, documents after documents, eyewitnesses, because we need all of that and it's available to us. You can know that this event occurred and you can be grounded sure to know that there is all that Jesus says going to happen. And knowing that takes seriously the need to come and be forgiven, to not drift through life thinking it will be all okay. These are serious things.